Thank you, Brother Bill, for probably the most unusual introduction I've ever had. And not only in that it was warm, but that it was such a production as probably could have only been carried off by an Anglican professor from the South. And you did this wonderfully, I want to assure you. I fell victim to the silver tongue ways of our executive secretary when he invited me to introduce Eric Ritter von Kanelt Ledeen at this luncheon, a man whom I have admired for years through National Review and through hearing him speak as one of the most cultivated men of our age. And then with what dismay I heard the news that Eric Ritter von Kanelt Ledeen had been felled by human disorders and our silver tongued secretary invited me to take his place. Well, what is one to think given the necessity of filling in for such a man as our brother Eric? Well, if I were a member of one of the bashful, self-effacing professions, such as the law, then I might have been dismayed and disheartened. However, being a member of a profession that the media that is not known for its low evaluation of its own characteristics, I was very happy and honored to try to do what I could for this occasion. As a member of the Philadelphia Society for a couple of decades, I'm likewise honored to be able to pinch hit even with a week's notice, which is not too bad. But I'm very happy to be here, and I thank you all for the opportunity to talk. Eric von Kanelt Ledeen was going to talk about the five wounds of Latin America, the enumeration of which he did not share with me. And so what I have chosen to do is to proceed without him and to talk rather about something that I might know a little bit more about than other topics, assuming that we in the media know anything about anything at all in the world. And so what I'm going to talk to you today about is Latin America. Indeed, it did seem meet, right, and our bounden duty to talk about Latin America because that was the topic before the House, but I wanted to do it from the standpoint of Texas. Now, that's not a topic that you can organize very neatly. We're perpetually firing at a moving target, those of us who try to talk about Latin America in the context of the state in which we live. And so I want to introduce the presentation with a few highlights and vignettes. Please do not jump to any conclusions because that's my function. I don't want to induce anybody else in here today to go into journalism. We've got enough of those as it is. Highlight number one. The population of Texas today is 29% Hispanic. Highlight number two. A third of the way into the 20th century, some demographers think, Hispanics in Texas will become the largest population grouping, with whites second, Anglo-Saxon white second, and blacks third. Highlight number three. The Hispanic school dropout rate is higher than that for blacks, which in turn is higher than that for whites. Enough of highlights, some vignettes. Vignette number one. In Dallas, where I live, Mexicans and blacks are engaged in a struggle for control of the Dallas Independent School District, an entity you might think at this stage nobody would want to control. With whites mostly on the sidelines, except in the role of school board members and taxpayers, there are, by accurate statistical count, there are more Christian Coalition members in the Harvard faculty than there are whites in the Dallas Independent School System. (Laughter) The Hispanic school superintendent, a woman, has been investigating corruption in the district. An assistant superintendent, who is black and a man, has filed sexual harassment charges against her. And I'm not making this up, you know. And there is an FBI investigation going on. Black and Hispanic demonstrators have faced off in public confrontations. Mexicans support the superintendent for her attempt to improve the lot of children in the district. And blacks say the lady is on a power trip. No resolution is in sight. Vignette number two, a story in the New York Times this very week. A small business in Amarillo. That's way out in West Texas, for those who think that the West is Springfield, Massachusetts. It is in the headlines for dismissing two Hispanic employees for the offense of speaking Spanish on the job. After a written request not to do so, the employees could not see the point of the request. It was their language. And one was quoted by the New York Times as saying, "I think he was wrong. It's like telling us to deny who we are, forget our heritage." Vignette number three. A new Texas law passed by the last legislature, signed by Governor George W. Bush. Under the new law, the top 10% of graduates in their high school classes are given automatic admission to state universities and colleges. And the reason, is the Hopwood decision. The famous Hopwood decision, whose impact and reverberations have gone around the country and is much disliked by those who interpret it as not simply the right but the duty of the educational establishment to make specific provision for black and Hispanic pupils by carving out and giving them a specific number of seats in colleges. Now, the legislature addressed itself to this task back in the spring by concluding that no matter how tough the high school, no matter how weak the high school, the top 10% of every graduating class would have automatic admission to a state university or college, and don't ask how many seats each university has to allocate. The lawmakers have served their political purpose nonetheless of bringing educational justice to the state of Texas. Vignette number four, and the last one that I want to bring up. And I squirm and blush to mention it in this particular company because one of the major players who is here, and he's a friend of mine, but it's important all the same. The story, the University of Texas law professor gets hammered, mauled, battered, beaten up on by politicians and academic bureaucrats for... Let's get down to cases, because this is what it was about, publicly supporting the Hopwood decision. In the words he used, this wasn't the point. The point was the departure from orthodoxy. And what is orthodoxy? It is that minorities, including the biggest minority, Hispanics, would rise as high as the sky if it were not for the patronizing, suffocating, repressive attitudes of the white power establishment in Texas, and blacks as well. That that was the orthodoxy which our professor violated and for which he paid in the common academic currency of vitriol and of statements by alleged academics that really have no part and no place in an environment of learning. Can we bring all these highlights, these vignettes together? Can we endow them with meaning? We can try. I'll try to give you some basic thoughts. Texas has some problems. Maybe. There's another possible synonym for problem. It reminds me of the time that we were building our house about 7 years ago, and our contractor, a a genteel Christian man would come to us and say, folks, we've got a new challenge today. Like the foundation is sinking. I like that spirit. A problem is a challenge. It's something to be overcome. It's less cataclysmic way of looking at things, and in my advancing age, it's a way I greatly prefer. I don't know any place in the world, I don't know any place in the United States where race relations are easy. But it happens that in Texas, like California, they are unusually complicated, what with all the different races to relate to. Now, if you take into account that this isn't the 1950s, and isn't going to be, never mind the leave it to Beaver remarks, that we have new realities to take into account, and those realities don't include the kind of dominance that Anglos exercised in Texas for 100 years, then what you have is some challenges. The biggest, it seems to me, is going to involve leapfrogging the white liberals, for whom I blame some of our biggest difficulties. A world without white liberals? Well, wouldn't it be wonderful? But well, we can probably forget it. It's never going to happen. We have to do the best we can, knowing that however well we do, the liberals are going to call for bigger government, more taxes, and more white guilt. With that in mind, let me say that if Hispanics are going to become full partners in tomorrow's Texas, and forgive me if I sound like a public service announcement, it won't be as big a leap as one might anticipate. We've lived side by side in Texas for a very long time, peacefully, most of the time since the Alamo. One of the larger pieces of Hollywood phony baloney is the scene in Giant, a picture I've seen probably 12 or 14 times, where Rock Hudson stands up at the end of the picture for a humble Mexican family trying to eat in Sarge's diner, and on the verge of being ejected by Sarge, and for his trouble, gets punched out by Sarge. There wasn't segregation of Hispanics in Texas in the 1950s. Hispanics, we called them Mexicans then, under the school laws, were white. They went to school with whites. The president of the student council at my middle school, or junior high school, as we called it in those days, was Moses Ramirez. In my school, were Justina Rosas and Amado Pena, not the artist, Melcher Cisneros, Esperanza Ram, Lee Gillen, David Pimentel, Carolyn Flores, whose father ran the Mexican Inn when he wasn't burning it down for insurance money. But that's another story entirely. My point simply is that these were folks, nothing more, nothing less. It never entered our mind, our naive 1950s Texas minds, that they didn't live under the same roof with Pat Grisafi, Joyce Ann Rosenblum, Billy Bob Johnson, all of us together, seniors 1959 or 1960 or 1961, it didn't matter. It was all the same culture. The tag end of our country's last peaceful time, before appetite and self-consciousness made our country a very different place than it has become since then. What's the difference between then and now? Numbers, of course, that's a big point. Call it the racial imbalance. Anglo-Saxon whites in those days were very much the majority and looked like staying that way forever. They didn't have much competition. Their dominance wasn't threatened. And when you don't feel threatened, you become increasingly benevolent toward those around you. But there was another difference to which attention is rarely called. The era of racial consciousness in which we now live had barely in those days begun. The era of racial consciousness had barely, at that time, begun. Outside the context of black-white segregation, for which I think most modern Texans are deeply sorry, we dealt with fellow Texans as fellow humans. I think it had not been for the intervention of government, which gave us the segregation laws in the first place, let's not forget, that we would have dealt with blacks as fellow humans. We certainly would have dealt with them more kindly, more mercifully, more charitably than we did. But that's beyond the scope of this paper. It's a conference in itself. I want to suggest that there was nothing fundamentally wrong with white-Mexican relations in the day when I was growing up in Texas. What happened? Well, as I suggested a few minutes ago, numbers, for one thing. The Hispanic population in Texas boomed. But was that the Hispanics' fault? I wouldn't say so. A number came here illegally, as to be sure they always had, in order to work. But the Texas job market lured many more here. There were openings for them, and they came to fill those openings, and we were happy to have them. They came to take up the minimum wage jobs that the native labor supply wouldn't or couldn't fill. There was a second factor that changed the shall we say, ethnic atmosphere. It was the coming of cultural liberalism. The coming of cultural liberalism. Cultural liberalism, which professes to be all about equality and opportunity, has mainly to do with two other things: guilt and entitlement. Who's guilty? Whites. You and I. And everybody we know, practically. Who's entitled? Non-whites. Who says so? Whites, chiefly. Whites who egg on blacks and Hispanics to believe and say some of these very same things and to act on those beliefs. And what does it all make for? Cultural muddle. Welcome to Cultural Muddle, Texas. Population 14 million with a few perennial troublemakers. But they've got clout, and that clout won't stop. Like at the University of Texas. It isn't enough that the usual ethnic politicians keep the pot stirred over admission requirements at state universities. The economic power elite, mostly white, drew up the menu, chunked in the ingredients, and then turned on the fire underneath. The power elite's contention is that racial quotas are good, not bad, that they're helpful, not hurtful. And always the line is, because we're becoming a multi-ethnic state, it behooves us to make sure that the ethnic groups in this state are well-educated. Now, that sounds persuasive until you start matching up ends and means. You get suspicious very quickly when you do that. Educating the ethnic groups of the state, of the non-white ethnic groups, turns out to mean patronizing them, scratching their ears, murmuring comfortable words about past repression. What it too rarely means is holding them, along with whites, to high standards of achievement and performance. Witness Hopwood. Witness the Hopwood decision. What was the big idea? Well, it was to populate the UT Law School with a suitable 21st century mix of whites, browns, and blacks, with special seats set aside for non-whites. And the white power elite at the University of Texas told you this explicitly, told you that the whole purpose of it was to provide for equal ethnic representation in the larger legal culture of the state of Texas, regardless of how bigoted, reactionary men and women in this state might interpret the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. This was the law school telling you this, the branch whose faculty gets paid for being on top of what the courts say and think, what the U.S. Circuit, what the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals had to say about this was, get out of here. You can't do this. It's discrimination. It's unconstitutional. So the University of Texas, joining hands with the guilty power structure, tries proudly to maneuver around the law of the land. It isn't very edifying. In fact, it's deeply divisive. And the language thing. What do we suppose two Mexican women get the idea that speaking Spanish on the job is an acceptable occupational procedure? They get it from the culture, from the larger Anglo-Saxon culture that encourages bilingualism and that looks on the right of everyone who lives here to speak in whatever tongue he or she finds most comfortable. These are the same guilty white liberals, the same ones who want law school quotas for minority students, the same ones who okay public school commemorations of Mexico's nationhood, Cinco de Mayo, but denigrate the Alamo and downplay Texas.